I don't think anybody cares where the gas comes from, just as long as there's a long-term, reasonably priced supply for the state.
The state sets goals for an in-state gas line. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 3rd of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Alaskan author hits the New York Times bestseller list again.
You know, I swore a mighty oath a long time ago that if Kate ever went stale on me, that I'd stop writing her, and she hasn't yet.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Governor Sarah Palin today made public her commitment to work toward a gas line from the North Slope to the Rail Belt, South Central, and, if possible, rural Alaska. She will be working toward what is called the Bullet Line that runs independent from a line to the Lower 48.
I think there's been so much talk about an in-state gas line, a lot more talk than action in the decades of discussion regarding the need for Alaska's gas to be used by Alaskans.
Palin said the goal is to provide affordable and reliable gas for South Central residents. Former Natural Resources Commissioner Harry Noah has been assigned as project manager. He says he is working on a fast timetable that would get gas to market by 2015. And to do that, he is combining studies and plans that have been developed in the past 2 years to get 500 cubic feet of gas per day to markets. Noah says previous work by NSTAR and the Natural Gas Development Authority leaves a clear path that needs to be followed.
Hopefully this is a project that will lay a foundation for future economic growth in the state. If we could come up with a reasonably priced energy supply that's significant enough to grow different manufacturing aspects of the economy, new mines and that type of thing, there's just a lot of benefit to us as Alaskans.
Noah says the plan still needs clarification in several areas during the next year, including finding a gas supply. He says the administration hasn't committed to a supply. They will take it from anywhere, the Nenana Basin, North Slope leaseholders, Cook Inlet, or Gubik.
I don't think anybody cares where the gas comes from, just as long as there's a long-term, reasonably priced supply for the state.
The plan will not be built with state money, and the state's involvement basically ends when an operator takes over. The administration has already submitted the legislation that will be needed to get the next planning phase on its way. Noah says the state's commitment is to put together the various proposals and options. He says without a goal, the idea for an in-state gas line won't make any progress. Legislation to create a death penalty in state law remains in the Judiciary Committee this week. After three hearings, Chairman Jay Ramras says the committee will take up House Speaker Mike Chenault's bill again over the next 2 weeks. The state has never imposed capital punishment, but eight men were executed when Alaska was a territory. After much debate, the territorial legislature abolished the death penalty in 1957. Since then, legislation has been reintroduced several times, never successfully. KTOO's Rebecca Shear has more.
Thus far, testimony has been overwhelmingly against the bill. The reasons are many.
The inordinate cost, the lack of value of death penalty as a deterrent, the outrageous capriciousness and lack of fairness in application of the death penalty.
That last reason, voiced here by former Alaska Director of Corrections Charles Campbell, harkens back to 1957. When territorial legislators Warren Taylor and Vic Fisher first moved to abolish capital punishment, their motivating factor was concern about a racial bias in the death penalty's application, a concern shared by Vicki Otte, executive director of the ANCSA Regional Association.
Native people represent over twice the prison population as they do the free population of Alaska. It is very likely this proposed death penalty will affect my people twice as much.
Adi's sentiments were echoed by other Alaska Natives, including Mike Smith, Director of Subsistence Resource Management for the Tanana Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks. He testified over the phone.
The question to this committee is not whether Alaska should have a death penalty, but rather whether it is proper to execute minorities in disproportionate numbers to their population.
The Palin administration endorses House Bill 9 in concept. Assistant Attorney General John Novak says that even people serving life sentences can find ways to kill again.
Is there a way to protect the innocent people in our community short of capital punishment? I submit that there isn't.
Under the legislation, a local district attorney would be able to seek the death penalty in cases of first-degree murder, pending agreement by the state attorney general. A person found to be mentally retarded would not be sentenced to death, but to prison. Once a person is sentenced to death, the case would be reviewed by the state Supreme Court. The method of execution would be lethal injection. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
Matanuska Susitna Borough Mayor and former state legislator Kurt Menard died this morning of cancer. Menard began his political service in 1984 on the Matsu School Board. In 1987, he went to Juneau, first as a state representative and then as a senator. In 2006, he became borough mayor. Patty Sullivan, public relations director for the borough, says through his daily actions, Menard showed an unwavering sense of responsibility to his constituents.
He would meet in his office with people over, you know, road problems, over flooding problems. He felt it was his duty to hear from his residents and try to help them any way he could.
Anchorage Senator Johnny Ellis is one of three remaining legislators who served with Menard in Juneau. Ellis remembers Menard as a politician who put his values before his career. A prime example was when Menard decided to leave the Republicans to join the Democrats.
That meant that he went from being in a majority power position to being a Democrat in the minority. And so it was a matter of principle and personal comfort level, as opposed to some of the folks that changed parties from going from the minority to the majority. You could say they were doing that for, you know, advancement reasons or ambition.
Last fall, Linda Menard, Kurt's wife, was elected to the state Senate. Ellis said her swearing in this January provided him with a special memory of his former colleague.
The pride on his face the day she was sworn in was really, really a gift to all of us. That he could, you know, launch her in her Senate career was just very special.
By profession, Menard was a dentist who had come to Alaska with the U.S. Air Force. He settled in the Matsu Valley in 1972 and set up a private practice. In 1975, he lost his right arm as the result of an electrical accident, but retrained himself to continue as a dentist with his left hand. In 2003, he was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. A year-long treatment resulted in remission for about 2 years. In 2007, he announced the cancer had returned. Sullivan says she will certainly miss one Menard quality in particular.
Government is a long and sometimes difficult process. We're at five-hour meetings, and he was so wonderful at throwing out that joke at 11 o'clock at night when people's tempers might have been high and we might have been frustrated. He was just so funny that he would break it all down and everyone in the room would just fall into laughter.
Governor Palin has ordered state flags lowered to half staff on Saturday, March 7th, the day of Menard's memorial service in Wasilla. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, perhaps the most well-loved spot of frost nip on the planet.
Yeah, man, I heard this. I heard this with all my life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Support for APRN coverage of Iditarod 2009 comes from Spinard Builders, supplying Devo paints, adding color and life to your home.
Southeast's summer tourist season could be bleak. That's the word from a number of experts addressing an industry conference in Ketchikan last week. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Tourists will still visit this summer, but there could be fewer than in recent years, and they're likely to spend less money, maybe a lot less money. Industry leaders detailed the situation at a conference on tourism in the new economy put on by the Ketchikan Visitors Bureau. Ron Peck of the Alaska Travel Industry Association says research shows people plan to spend less money on vacations this year, and they plan to do it closer to home.
The bottom line is, for a variety of reasons, folks are looking at taking shorter haul destination trips, especially given what's going on with the economy right now. So instead of thinking about coming to Alaska or Europe, they're looking at, if they live in Minnesota, they're going to the Wisconsins and the Michigans.
Even cruise ship travelers are looking nearby. That means Alaska faces competition from expansion in the East Coast cruise market, and the more adventurous and well-heeled passengers have growing options worldwide.
10 new ships are coming online this year in this season, but none of them are coming to Alaska. There is no growth in Alaska in the cruise industry. There's actually a decline in 2009 and 2010.
Research shows travelers are hunting for bargains, and they're going to find them. Most cruise lines are already committed to this year's Alaska sailings, so they're offering deep discounts to fill their ships. Sportsman Cove Lodge owner Larry McCory says that will extend to tours and other purchases on shore.
There's going to be some heavy discounting in our industry, and not only does it affect bottom lines, but it affects the demographics of who comes to visit us. And they generally don't spend. They're bargain hunters, and they generally don't spend in other areas as they're passing through town.
Tour businesses hope higher spending patterns return once the economy recovers. Some estimate that could take two seasons. Industry impacts involve more than fewer cheaper visitors. Lodge owner McQuarrie says some tour businesses are having a hard time getting financing.
We're seeing still tight money. It's tough trying to borrow operating capital to get you through the year. I can tell you personally, I've been turned down twice for just a line of credit. And we have been in business a long time, and I'm imagining how other operators are being affected if we're having trouble getting money.
But it's not all bad news. Research shows tourists remain interested in Alaska. The Travel Industry Association's PEC says they're drawn by our scenery, our fishing, our wildlife, and our colorful characters, including our governor. But while people continue to be attracted to the state, they're not as ready to commit to a trip as they used to be.
The folks that responded said, yeah, we're coming, but we're not sure we're going to come, and we're going to wait and hold and look off. Okay? So again, for us, in a destination that's 5 months long, that's a little scary.
Tour operators and the statewide association are adding promotions and publicizing deals in hopes of attracting bargain-conscious travelers. Rick Erickson of Cruise Line Agencies of Alaska says he's not ready to write off the season.
Will the ship sail full? I'm hopeful that they will. Will the passengers have disposable income to spend in our communities, in our stores, on our tours, the high-end stuff? I'm optimistic that they will, but there are certain trends out there now that may not be the case.
While cruise bookings and tour sales are down, optimists say they're hoping for a late surge. Many travelers to Alaska are internet savvy, and they've been responding to at least some of the online sales. The next few months will show how much that has made a difference. In Ketchikan, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Airplane construction isn't what normally comes to mind when you consider middle school education, but students at Anchorage's Begich Middle School will have the chance to build an experimental homemade model. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
About 15 minutes into the assembly, a remote control model plane began swooping over the students' heads. But this gossamer-like cross between a propeller-driven butterfly and a miniature stealth bomber was not to be confused with the real project that had brought the Begich Middle School students to the 8:15 a.m. assembly. The flying demonstration was a mere appetizer. The real purpose came just before the end of the assembly, when the PowerPoint screen rose toward the ceiling and the curtains on the stage drew apart, with an announcement from Begich technology teacher Dan Carey.
We'll go ahead and show you the airplane now.
The open curtains revealed the partially completed spruce and plywood skeleton of a biplane. Gene Fisher is the Begich Middle School principal.
It all started with Barrington Irving and an assembly and the FAA staff wanting to help kids connect with careers and learn about the aviation field. It's amazing to me, every time I turn around, somebody's donated something to the project.
In 2007, then 23-year-old Barrington Irving became the youngest person ever to fly solo around the world. Irving has visited several Anchorage schools where he extolled working toward life goals as well as careers in aviation. He made such an impression on the baggage students, Fisher began her hunt to find a project plane.
It's a model that was partially built by a kindergarten teacher in New Mexico. She was killed in a car accident. And a person in New Mexico read an email from the Experimental Aircraft Association folks and FAA folks here saying there's a school in Alaska that wants to build a plane. And he donated that plane to us.
Shipping via truck to Anchorage was donated by Carlisle Transportation Systems. Stapleton, along with many others from Anchorage's aviation community, will donate time and skills to the project. The University of Alaska Fairbanks is contributing an engine. FAA personnel will also participate, in particular, by inspecting and approving every step of the construction.
I expect that there will be work crews on Saturdays where we spread the plane out here on the multipurpose room floor on tarps, and we'll put it together piece by piece. So we might have a fabric group that does the wing, and then the fuselage group, and the wheels, and I don't even know all the parts that we're going to be working on.
Fisher says the student applicants will have to show they're committed to the project and the time it will take, possibly into the summer. Technology teacher Carrie says student selection is the next tough step.
They're pretty excited to the point that I'm a little afraid we're going to have 1,200 kids trying to show up on Saturdays to work on this thing, and we don't need quite that many. We'll do as many kids as we can, and we might have to go in shifts. Not everyone will be able to be here at all times, but it looks like a lot of kids want to be involved.
Besides the construction, students will also go on aviation-oriented field trips, as well as be able to practice on a flight simulator at the middle school, complete with a Pete and Pole program. Baggage is not the first Alaskan school to have a build-a-plane project. In 2007, the FAA oversaw a similar program in the western Alaska village of Hooper Bay. This is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Last week, Newton Marshall became the first Jamaican musher to complete the Yukon Quest, and now he may be turning his sights on the Iditarod. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the road from his sunny island nation to the frigid sport of sled dog racing was not always an easy one.
When 25-year-old Jamaican Newton Marshall crossed the finish line of the Yukon Quest in 13th place, it wasn't just about a guy from the tropics succeeding in the world's toughest sled dog race. After finishing in the early morning darkness, Marshall said he'd reflected on the experience over the final miles.
I was thinking about, boy, everything is hard in life, no matter what you're doing. Yeah, this one is a tough one, but, you know, everything is tough.
Greeted by supporters at the finish line, Marshall wore his usual big smile and a spot of frost nip on his nose.
Yeah, man, I earned this with all my life.
Marshall said the toughest part of the race was climbing Eagle Summit, an obstacle he and two fellow mushers helped each other over. Marshall says it took a lot of resolve to complete the race.
You have to put your mind to it and want to do it. And if you think it's too hard and you don't want to do it, then don't try it. You have to have a really strong heart.
Jamaican dog sled team founder Danny Melville was overwhelmed with pride when Marshall made it in.
Unbelievable. Welling up inside of me. Tears coming to my eyes.
Melville looked back on the long journey Marshall made from a humble beginning when he was selected for the team from the staff at his ecotourism resort.
He was a gardener, then he worked as a horseback riding guide, and then we just selected him for this, and that's it. He's a sensitive kid, you know. He genuinely loves animals. And the truth is, that's part of our story, because a lot of Jamaicans don't like animals, particularly dogs. They're afraid of them.
Melville says Marshall mixed work taking tourists on dog cart rides with school, where he learned to read and write. It all happened as he and the team started to get international attention, and just as everything was going great, Marshall got into trouble. Melville says Marshall took his teacher's car, wrecked it, and lied about what happened. Melville blames the incident on all the changes in Marshall's life.
So much was happening to him. He's in a documentary, he's gone to Minnesota, he's got a U.S. visa. So all of those things happened in his life, and I think it kind of went to his head a bit, and boom, he had a reality check.
The incident got Marshall kicked off the team, but he redeemed himself by returning to school, working hard at the kennel, and paying back his teacher for the car. Marshall's renewed focus got him selected to go and train with Quest champion Hans Gott in Whitehorse for his own run at the race. Gott says he's seen a transformation in the young man who showed up at his kennel 2 years ago.
I mean, obviously, he had no clue what he got himself into. It just, everything was just an incredible experience for him. And so I think it was a lot of curiosity from him, you know, about life in general. I think, yes, he did become a different person, you know, from somebody who would just blindly follow orders and not really think about anything, you know. I mean, he does make his own decisions now, and I think that's really good for him.
Gott says Marshall has learned a lot about the craft of mushing and traveling in the cold, but that he came with the most essential quality for any musher, a love of dogs.
He built a bond with that team like very few mushers out there have, I think, and that's what got him to that finish line.
Gott says he looks forward to potentially preparing Marshall for a run at the Iditarod. Marshall says he doesn't know for sure if that's in his future, but wants to keep mushing.
Yeah, man, most definitely. We'll just have to just see what's up next. Anything is possible.
Newton Marshall is already proof of that. I'm Dan Bross.
Prolific Alaskan author Dana Stabenow's latest book in the Kate Chugach mystery series quickly hit the New York Times bestseller list after its recent release. Whisper to the Blood is the 16th novel in the series and one of 31 books Stabenow has written. I spoke with her right before Whisper to the Blood's release. Stabenow says Kate's character was born out of exhaustion after she had written two science fiction novels.
And so I thought, okay, I'm going to take a break here. But you don't want to quit writing because your skills will deteriorate. So I had to think of some kind of like, you know, little project to keep the writing muscle well exercised in between, you know, while I was taking this rest. And I'd been reading a lot of mysteries at the time. So and I thought, well, gee, you know, I wonder if I could write a mystery. I mean, no kidding. You know, I wonder if I can write a mystery. And so I just helped my aunt, who had a job with a bush pilot in the Wrangell-St. Elias Mountains, pack up and move back to Cordova. So I'd just been in the Wrangell-St. Elias Park. I'd been out to McCarthy. I'd been all over the mine. And my one rule for writing this book was, okay, you can't do any research. All you can use is what's between your ears and in the Alaska Almanac Book of Facts. That was it. So I used my current memories, you know, my very recent memories of Wrangell-St. Elias. I was raised with Aleuts, so Kate was an Aleut. I made her a woman because it's always easier to write in the same gender, and Kate Chugach was born. When I was in the Wrangell-St. Elias Mountains, the people that I met there, to say that their language was incendiary concerning the Park Service is to grossly understate the case. So naturally, I was going to kill off a park ranger in the first book.
How do you know what will be coming in the future? Do you see Kate in other continuing on in other adventures?
Yeah, I swore a mighty oath a long time ago that if Kate ever went stale on me, that I'd stop writing her. And she hasn't yet. She's still making me laugh. She's still making me gasp. She still sometimes makes me cry. I wrote a great scene here just a couple of days ago where she shoots a bear, and I practically could feel it with her, a charging grizzly. And I thought, well, okay, we haven't gotten tired of this yet, have we?
That's interesting because that sort of leads into what I wanted to ask next, which is, when you work with a character for so long, 16 books now, how real is this person that you've created to you? Do you ever argue with her when you're writing a chapter?
It's been a while since that has happened. I think it's because her character is so strong now and I'm so familiar with it. She as precious as it sounds, she's dictating almost to me. It's almost like speaking in tongues sometimes. But that did happen one time, the seventh book breakup. In the outline, I had her attracted to the villain, and Kate's just smarter than me, and she fought me every step of the way. For a month, for something like 75 pages, I tried to make that outline work, and it just wasn't. And so I had to scrap a whole month's work. That wasn't a good month, let me tell you. I scrapped a whole month's work and started over, essentially started over. That's a breakup, which is what a friend of mine referred to as a caper novel. And I literally threw everything at Kate that I possibly could because I was so angry at her for not obeying me.
Alaska certainly has no lack of interesting people and surprising events. How much do you rely on what's actually happening in the state for sort of developing your stories, and how much is just created out of your imagination?
Well, I always say, and yeah, it's a smart remark, I always say I never let the truth get in the way of a good story, and I don't. I'm my father's daughter in that respect. But yes, of course, I yank headlines right out of the newspapers and off the air. I'm, you know, as long as Alaskans keep misbehaving, I'm in business, and so is Kate.
You're obviously a very prolific writer. How much of your day is spent writing?
It depends on which part of the book I'm in. The first part of the first half of the book, before you get to what I call the hump, it's just sheer drudgery. I mean, it's everything I can do to force my feet to the fire. And it's true, I've got an outline. It's not like I don't know where I'm going, where I want the character to go, what the overall story arc is, how it works into the total story arc of the entire series. But it's just really, the first half of the book is always really tough. And then there's a point when you get to the top and you have a couple of revelatory moments. And I really can't say any more than that, because it's when you achieve critical mass, and it happens in every writer's life on every project that they do. And you think, oh, wow, I get it now. Wow. And then it's this mad gallop down the end of the hill. I love that time, because it's like I can't stay away from the computer. I can't stay away from these characters and these people.
And give us just a little tease about what Whisper to the Blood involves.
I picked up the pebble mine and I put it down in Kate's Park. I expect to get a whole bunch of guff from Alaskans about that.
Alaskan mystery writer Dana Stabenow. Her latest novel, Whisper to the Blood, hit the New York Times bestseller list early last week. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rebecca Shear and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping you reach educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. Information at 1-888-4-ALASKA. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan. Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.